Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 17th of February 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. This is episode number 66 of our series, and we're concentrating on British history at the moment, and particularly on Alfred the Great. And I have two co-hosts with me, Truthvids from truthvids.net and the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Truthvids, how are you doing? How is life treating you?
All good, Sven. Great to be back, as always.
Excellent, excellent. I hear you added something to your website the other day that you wanted to let listeners know about.
Yeah, I mentioned the donations page already, but I've also been working on a book. You can kind of preview it. I haven't set that up quite yet, but where you can click on the left bar and there's a picture of the book and you can preview it. I'm learning how to format it all so people can take a look and give me feedback, because this is kind of new to me, right? Whether you read it on a Kindle or this software or that, or whether it's A4 format or A5. So it'd be great to get feedback so I can format the book. And if anyone wants to contribute to the formation of the book, they can always hit the donation page. So thanks for mentioning that, Sven.
Well, that's great stuff. I do recommend people check out truthvids.net. It's full of interesting stuff on there, loads of content on there. Yeah, it's well worth paying it a visit. Patriarch, how are you doing? How is life treating you?
Hey, Sven. Yeah, good to be back. Thanks. Life's good. What can I say? Life's good. So, yeah, it's all good. And I look forward to purchasing a copy of Truthvids book. So I'll definitely be getting one of those.
Yeah, it'd be good to have a look at that. Obviously, his videos are well worth taking a look at as well. They're well researched and very well put together. Okay, let's get back into Alfred the Great here. We talked a little bit about the law courts last time, and now we're going to go back to Asser's Life of King Alfred to talk about Alfred and the judges. And we'll start with chapter 106, his correction of unjust and incompetent judges. He used to also sit at judicial hearings for the benefit of both his nobles and commons, who often quarrelled fiercely among themselves at the meetings of the eldermen and sheriffs, so that hardly one of them admitted the justice of what had been decided by these eldermen and sheriffs. In consequence of this pertinacious and obstinate dissension, all felt constrained to give sureties to abide by the decision of the king, and both parties hastened to carry out their engagements. But if anyone was conscious of injustice on his side in the suit, though by law and agreement he was compelled, however reluctant, to come for judgment before a judge like this, yet with his own good will he never would consent to come, for he knew that in that place no part of his evil practice would remain hidden. And no wonder, for the king was a most acute investigator in executing his judgments, as he was in all other things. He inquired into almost all the judgments which were given in his absence throughout all his dominion, whether they were just or unjust. If he perceived there was iniquity in those judgments, he would, of his own accord, mildly ask those judges, either in his own person or through others who were in trust with him, why they had judged so unjustly, whether through ignorance or malevolence. That is, whether for the love or fear of anyone, or the hatred of another, or the desire of someone's money. At length, if the judges acknowledged they had given such judgment because they knew no better, he discreetly and moderately reproved their inexperience and folly in such terms as these: "I greatly wonder at your assurance that, whereas by God's favour and mine, you have taken upon you the rank and office of the wise, yet you have neglected the studies and labours of the wise. Either therefore at once give up the administration of the earthly powers which you possess, or endeavour more zealously to study the lessons of wisdom. Such are my commands." At these words, the eldermen and sheriffs would be filled with terror at being thus severely corrected, and would endeavour to turn with all their might to the study of justice, so that, wonderful to say, almost all his eldermen, sheriffs and officers, though unlearned from childhood, gave themselves up to the study of letters, choosing rather to acquire laboriously an unfamiliar discipline than to resign their functions. But if anyone from old age or the sluggishness of an untrained mind was unable to make progress in his literary studies, he would order his son, if he had one, or one of his kinsmen, or if he had no one else, his own freedman or servant, whom he had long before advanced to the office of reading, to read Saxon books before him, night and day, whenever he had any leisure. And then they would lament with deep sighs from their inmost souls that in their youth they had never attained to such studies. They counted happy the youth of the present day, who could be delightfully instructed in the liberal arts, while they considered themselves wretched in that they had neither learned these things in their youth, nor, now that they were old, were they able to do so. This skill of young and old in acquiring letters I have set forth as a means of characterising the aforesaid king. So he basically sat down at the court, and he wanted to hear what was going on. If he wasn't at the court, he looked at the what the results of all these trials were. And if he thought that something was going on that shouldn't be going on, he reproved the judge. I mean, I can recall that he hanged something like 100 judges. And I can't find where I got that from, but I remember that from the last time that I looked at Alfred the Great. And they had problems with getting people to the court because the judges were known for being corrupt. So he literally cleaned up all of this corruption, and you had judges that weren't actually able to read, because as we told at the beginning, there was nobody really in the kingdom that knew how to read and write. So he made sure that these judges could all read, so that they could read up on the law and they could read up on Alfred's laws, and basically people began to trust in the courts again after this. So he was very well known for being a lawgiver, as we talked about last time with some of Alfred's laws, and they wanted to connect him with Moses the lawgiver. So he took this very, very seriously, because these judges were judging with his authority, and his authority was coming from God. So it was very important that that they judged correctly, and there wasn't any corruption. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz?
Yeah, it's important to have really strong laws, because that's how civilization flourishes, right? That you have trust in your civilization, and you can like work and you know that your house or your goods aren't going to be robbed, and if anything happens, you don't need to go to war with your neighbor. You can just go to a judge and get it back, and it stops violence, and it's necessary. But this is really good of Alfred, because if the judges and the people knew that he was always checking, it would keep them in line, right? Just in case a judge got caught taking a bribe or something. And they always had the problems with the different classes, that lords believed they were above the law, that they could just do whatever they want and never have to face the consequences. So here you see that Alfred's keeping them in line, and that's important to the civilization, right?
Yeah, they had. They had different fines depending on which class you were, but you were still under the law. You know, you could still be found guilty of something that you shouldn't have been doing, and you would have been fined, and you would have been fined according to your class. If somebody had been hurt, that was the principle of the Wehrguild. A lord, the body parts of a lord were worth more than the body parts of a peasant, basically, that sort of thing. But everybody was under the same law, and they had to be treated justly by these judges. And these judges would have to step down if they were found to have been carrying out wrong judgments. Then he got rid of them. So I say, I think there were something like 100 judges that were actually hanged for corruption, to make an example of them. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, they were clearly very wise men. Obviously, they encouraged the other judges to learn the wisdom that they value in high regard, but they also recognize that everything filters down from the top, doesn't it? So it's the same thing, like the head of the snake. It's the head of benevolence. It all trickles down and has an effect. So they were aware that if they wanted to sustain a great kingdom, that they need to lead by example, essentially, and keep things in check. It's that quality control. So, it's just a sign of the great wisdom, and how great it would have been a great time to live, I think, in that kingdom at that time.
Yeah, and the point that he's making there, what you've got there is these elders of the tribe, they're elders of the nation that were being the judges, and they were needing to learn. And what Asa is saying there is that they lamented the fact that they weren't able to learn as children. And this was the other aspect of what Alfred did. He set up a school because he was very big on education. If we look at Wikipedia for our next piece of notes here, Alfred established a court school for the education of his own children, those of the nobility, and a good many of lesser birth. And that's the way that Asa puts it. There they studied books in both English and Latin, so in Saxon and Latin, and devoted themselves to writing to such an extent they were seen to be devoted and intelligent students of the liberal arts. He recruited scholars from the continent and from Britain, that would be from Wales, to aid in the revival of Christian learning in Wessex and to provide the king with personal instruction. Grimbald and John the Saxon came from Francia. Plegmund, whom Alfred appointed Archbishop of Canterbury in 890, Bishop Werferth of Worcester, Æthelstan, and the royal chaplains Werwulf from Mercia and Asa from St. David's in southwestern Wales. And remember, he also brought over artificers and metal workers. So he also had these teachers, and Alfred took part in the teaching. And it was very important to him that it was the brightest people got the chance to actually go to school. So that's where it says a good many of lesser birth. They were like incredibly bright youngsters, and they were given access to this court school, which was something which had never been done before. Any thoughts on this, Truthvids?
Yeah, we used to have grammar schools, right? I mean, we've probably still got a handful left, but they've purposely been destroyed. And the whole point was not everybody needs, like, we've been brainwashed into thinking you need 10, 15 years of education. You really don't. You just need to learn the basics, like maths, a bit of history, to read, to write, you know, just a few years, and then it's good to go into a profession and learn a skill. And here we see that usually just the best of you know, the poor people had that opportunity to take it further if there was a point. But not everybody needs you know, to go to university and all that, but this was a great way how you know, the best and brightest could learn and be taught, and then they could use that intelligence for the good of the civilization with their education, and the other people could still have good professions in other fields, you know, like a blacksmith or a farmer or, you know, whatever. And also, as we've said before, all the nobility would have to be able to read and write and learn the history so that they can lead the people and rule over them justly. And that's what Alfred's essentially setting up here, right?
Yeah, I like the way there you're pointing out that this was the origin of the grammar schools and originally the university system as well. I mean, it would only be that if you were the absolute very brightest, you would go to university and the state would pay for that. Of course, it doesn't anymore. People have to pay themselves and they have to get loans. And that means that the standards of the university are dropping because you've got people that are paying to get in there. And then they want to come out with a certificate to show that, you know, so they get their money's worth. You know, if you're paying 30 or 40 grand to go through university, you know, you can't be failing these people because they paid a lot of money. So you get a dropping of standards. And now we've also got far more foreign students than pretty much anything else that are propping up our university system. So the standards go down, whereas before we had the very, very brightest people, only the very brightest people, and they got the best education. And then the sort of things that they're going to invent and that they're going to develop for the nation are going to be a huge boon to the country, whereas we don't have that anymore. And you can see that this idea of giving education to the brightest people, that started with Alfred. And as you pointed out there, Truthvids, then you get the grammar schools. So I think you had the 11 plus exam. So everybody would take this exam, and everybody the youngsters that did really well at this exam, they would get siphoned off into the very best schooling. So they got the very best schooling. Whereas now we say, oh no, everybody's got to be all educated together. So you got, you got types that really aren't going to be that good at intellectual stuff, but they might be good with their hands. You know, they're going to be mucking around in the lessons, and the teacher is going to have to lower everything to the standards of the lowest person in the class so that they can keep up. And the brightest pupils just aren't going to be challenged. It's a great shame, I think, the way that our education system has ended up today. Alfred's ideas here, you know, they're timeless ideas, really. You know, select the brightest out of the children and give them the very best education. Patriarch, any thoughts on Alfred's school?
Yeah, it's almost like caste system 2.0, isn't it, in some ways? You know, it kind of separates people based on their qualities and skills. So obviously it's a sifting process, I think, and that way you got the very best of of your citizens. And so those that weren't so intellectual, I guess, didn't have to waste so much time and were put to good use where their skills were better suited. And then same with the brightest minds, I guess. It was it just sounds like caste system 2.0.
Yeah, you know, it's like meritocracy in a way, because you think that gives a chance for the brightest students to rise up a class. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. But caste by ability, and not necessarily caste by fate or social status, if you know what I mean. So that's what I mean, 2.0, it's kind of evolved to the point where it takes into account the innate abilities of a character as opposed to just how they, where they happen to be born and who by.
Yeah, so you got the best of both worlds. You got the aristocracy and people that were born into that, but then you've also got people that just turned out to be the brightest, and they were given an education, so they were given a chance so that they could transcend their caste status and work their way up into another caste. So you've got meritocracy, and you've also got aristocracy, which I think is the best way of doing things. That's making the most out of what we have. It was very clever of him to set this up. I'm not sure if they had anything similar in the Roman Empire or anything like that. But we have the startings of this. Well, he understood that it didn't matter what class you were still part of the nation, and you still needed to be given the chance to actually do your very best. So we do the opposite now, don't we? We say to people, well, we'll raise you up and we'll drop the standards for you so that we can let you in if you happen to be of a different race or different ethnicity or different sexuality. And we've sort of done away with the meritocracy, where people, if they worked hard and if they had the intellectual acumen, then they could get to these high positions, whereas now you would be turned away because you're the wrong colour, basically. We're moving on to the next subject here, which is Alfred's holy war against the Danes, and this is from Wikipedia as well. The portrayal of the West Saxons' resistance to the Vikings by Asser and the Chronicler as a Christian holy war was more than just rhetoric or propaganda. It reflected Alfred's own belief in a doctrine of divine rewards and punishments, rooted in a vision of a hierarchical Christian world order in which God is the Lord to whom kings owe obedience and through whom they derive their authority over their followers. The need to persuade his nobles to undertake work for the common good led Alfred and his court scholars to strengthen and deepen the conception of Christian kingship that he had inherited by building upon the legacy of earlier kings, including Offa, and clerical writers, including Bede and Alcuin, and various participants in the Carolingian Renaissance. And the Carolingian Renaissance was Charlemagne's Renaissance. This was not a cynical use of religion to manipulate his subjects into obedience, but an intrinsic element in Alfred's worldview. He believed, as did other kings in 9th century England and Francia, that God had entrusted him with the spiritual as well as the physical welfare of his people. If the Christian faith fell into ruin in his kingdom, if the clergy were too ignorant to understand the Latin words they butchered in their offices and liturgies, if the ancient monasteries and collegiate churches lay deserted out of indifference, he was the one answerable before God, as Josiah had been in the Old Testament. Alfred's ultimate responsibility was the pastoral care of his people. So that projected itself onto the war that he had against the Danes. And so he saw it that the reason why they were losing against the Danes is because they hadn't been behaving in a Christian way. And when they won the battle against the Danes and got the peace with Guthrum, it was like that what they needed to do now was obey God. And the king has to set this example. And when the king got baptized, as that original king in Kent did, or some of the ones in France, when they would get baptized, all their people would then get baptized and become Christian as well. You didn't have this, the individual could choose his religion. The individual's religion was the religion of the nation, the religion of the people under the king. So whatever the king did, the people did, which is why we saw with Guthrum, there was, I think, 20 odd of his men that also got baptized at the same time as Guthrum did. So religion played a really important part in this, and we saw that as well with when we were talking about Arthur as well, didn't we, in the golden age that Arthur instituted, which was basically obeying Christian law because he had won these battles. If they lost a battle, it was seen that God willed it that they would lose that battle. If they won the battle, it would be seen that God willed it that they would win that battle. And when they were fighting against the Danes, they saw them as the heathens, the pagans, and God was behind Alfred. God was behind the Christian Saxons against these pagans, basically. And they had to defeat the pagans first, defeat them, and then offer them Christianity. And if they took Christianity, then they would look on them as equals. And as we see here, he talks about his undertake work for the common good. And that was the Commonweal. That was the start of the Commonwealth, and it was his nobles that had to do this to improve the situation for everyone. And you had this concept of noblesse oblige, where the nobles were obliged to look out for the peasants and to give them arms. And again, we see this with Alfred. Asser tells us that he would give out arms to the poor, and the poor would come to the gates of wherever he was, and he would give them whatever he could give them. As it says in the Bible, cast your bread upon the waters so that it comes back to you. So whatever he gave out to the peasants, if you say it was like within a closed system, and if you say, well, he was giving money to the peasants' currency or whatever, that currency would then get spent back into circulation, and it would continue to circulate around the group. Whereas if you're giving out charity to people that are outside the group, which you have, would say, with multiculturalism, you have people here from other ethnic groups, and you give wealth to them, they then send it back off to their ethnic group in another country. So the charity just gets siphoned away from the group. So it ends up being a waste of charity. But when you have a closed group, like we had here, within Alfred's realm, as it were, the money that he gave out to the peasants would stay within circulation and would work it and would continue doing good, basically, because it couldn't get out of the system. So whatever wealth was created, it stayed and it was passed around. And I think that's what that phrase, cast your bread upon the waters so that it may come back to you, I think that's what it's referring to. Charity begins at home, for very good reasons. Truthfeds, any thoughts on Alfred's holy war against the Danes?
Yeah, I was just going to agree with what you said, that when if you hoard all the wealth, then all that's going to do is create poverty, and then there'll be, your own people will be forced to criminal activities just to survive. They'll have to rob people out of necessity, whilst if you help them, it's not necessary that they're poor just because they're demented or something. It's just because they haven't had the opportunity. And if you help them get things together that so they can get tools and they can work and they can learn a trade, then they can have a family, and they'll have many descendants. And who knows, in a few generations, your descendants might marry their descendants. So you're actually helping them, and also you're just helping, your country, your nation, and your people. And, back to the holy war, the kings, because they really read the Bible back then, they understood that, essentially, God, if he wanted, he could just destroy all the enemies and just, return now and bring us all to heaven if he wanted. He can do that at any point, but he wants us to go through this world at present to learn evil, and you realize that when you become a degenerate society, everything gets bad. And when you know, you have a leader who forces everybody to be good and create a good civilization, you get good times. So it's a learning experience for us for the coming you know, return of Christ, the kingdom, that you have to have a moral civilization. You cannot have an immoral civilization. It will always collapse, and that's the lesson here, right? And the leader has to be a moral person. If he's immoral, then the kingdom or the civilization is going to suffer because of his actions. And that's why Alfred understood he had to lead by example, right?
Yeah, and also this today we have this idea of equality. We try to make everybody equal. Back then, they understood that, you know, there was a need for poor people so that the nobles had a chance to give charity, because charity was a virtue. If there wasn't any poor people, you wouldn't be able to do charity, and it was essential that you are charitable to your brethren, to so that we actually show that we have virtue and we increase the virtue within ourselves. So it was seen that the poor were a necessity, so that the rich and the nobles had a chance to be charitable, basically. Totally different to the way that we look at it today. We try to equalize everything. I think the way that they looked at it back then, it was much more like a cycle. You know, the rich would give to the poor and the poor would give to the rich, and you have a continual cycle and a continual increase in virtue and a continual increase in the wealth, in the commonwealth of the people. And that was the way that it was looked at. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, what's been discussed is all quite interesting, isn't it? In terms of the dynamic of, obviously, you need the poor in order to, you know, have the rich. It's all it all works in tandem as God's kind of design and creation. It's like you can't have light without dark, because they essentially define each other. And, you know, in essence, the way society is structured, you know, the all the virtues, the array of godly virtues are kind of defined within that, and how it's set out. On the point of baptism, that was quite interesting as well, and kind of made me think about how, obviously, baptism I don't believe is necessary for salvation, because obviously Christ is the, you know, he baptized with spirit, and but the baptism of water, obviously, especially back then, as a symbol, was almost like a it's like a raising of the flag, isn't it? It's it was a powerful symbol, that people, a visual representation of someone being cleansed and saved, you know, with their sins being washed away, and them kind of being adopted into this brotherhood of Christendom. And, you know, I think as a symbol, a metaphor, it was powerful. And in some ways, I think that's where baptism can become necessary amongst people. To just influence, I guess, and to help spread.
Yeah, I think it was very, very useful at the time, and that, you know, and that's what it helped to do, was to bond everybody together. They'd all been through this ritual, which was saying, "Right, we are now Christian. We have all been baptized." So that's why it was seen as being so important. Yeah, I agree with you there, Patriarch. Next, we'll move back to Asser's Life of King Alfred, and this is when Alfred first translated Latin into English, because he became a huge translator of books. We'll talk a bit more about that and look at some of the things that he translated in a bit. But this is what Asser has to say about it. Alfred begins to translate from Latin, and that's the title. In that same year, also the oft-mentioned Alfred, king of the Anglo-Saxons, by divine inspiration, first began, on one and the same day, to read Latin and to translate at the same time. And of course, that is translating into Saxon what would become English. But that this may be clearer to those who are ignorant, I will relate the cause of this long delay in beginning. On a certain day, we were both of us sitting in the king's chamber, talking on all kinds of subjects, as usual, and it happened that I read to him a quotation out of a certain book. While he was listening to it attentively with both ears, and pondering it deeply within his innermost mind, he suddenly showed me a little book which he carried in his bosom, wherein were written the daily courses, together with certain psalms and prayers which he had read in his youth, and thereupon he bade me write the quotation in that book. Hearing this, and perceiving in part his active intelligence and goodness of heart, together with his devout resolution of studying divine wisdom, I gave, though in secret, yet with hands uplifted to heaven, boundless thanks to Almighty God, who had implanted such devotion to the study of wisdom in the king's heart. But since I could find no blank space in that book wherein to write the quotation, it being all full of various matters, I delayed a little, chiefly that I might stir up the choice understanding of the king to a higher knowledge of the divine testimonies. Upon his urging me to make haste and write it quickly, I said to him, "Are you willing that I should write that quotation on some separate leaf? Perhaps we shall find one or more other such which will please you. And if that should happen, we shall be glad that we have kept this by itself." "Your plan is good," said he. So I gladly made haste to get ready a pamphlet of four leaves, at the head of which I wrote what he had bidden me, and that same day I wrote in it, at his request, and as I had predicted, no less than three other quotations which pleased him. From that time we daily talked together and investigated the same subject by the help of other quotations which we found and which pleased him, so that the pamphlet gradually became full, and deservedly so, for it is written, "The righteous man builds upon a moderate foundation, and by degrees passes on to greater things." Thus, like a most productive bee, flying far and wide, and scrutinizing the fenlands, he eagerly and unceasingly collected various flowers of Holy Scripture, with which he copiously stored in the cells of his mind. When that first quotation had been copied, he was eager at once to read, and to translate it into Saxon, and then to teach many others, even as we are assured concerning that happy thief who recognized the Lord Jesus Christ, his Lord, aye, the Lord of all men, as he was hanging on the venerable gallows of the Holy Cross, and with trustful petition, casting down of his body no more than his eyes, since he was so entirely fastened with nails that he could do nothing else, cried with humble voice, "Christ, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom." Since it was only on the cross that he began to learn the elements of the Christian faith. Inspired by God, Alfred began the rudiments of Holy Scripture on the sacred feast of St. Martin. Then he went on, as far as he was able, to learn the flowers collected from various quarters by any and all of his teachers, and to reduce them into the form of one book, although jumbled together, until it became almost as large as a psalter. This book he called his Enchiridion, or Handbook, because he carefully kept it at hand day and night, and found, as he then used to say, no small consolation therein. So it seems that he's saying that there was some kind of a miracle. It is referred to as a miracle that Alfred was suddenly able to translate from Latin into Saxon, and then he continued to translate works, and there are a lot of works that he is supposedly said to have translated. I don't think they believe he translated all of them now, but he certainly translated some of them. And we also see here that he kept this book on him that with everything written down in it, all these important things that would be remembered, and maybe he would have people read that book to him, and eventually he learned how he could translate from Latin into Saxon himself. And again, we see here this important motif of the bee that was very important to Asser for some reason. I really should actually look up the significance of the bee, because I there's something told me there that was something to do with the Merovingian kings and something to do with King Solomon as well. There's some esoteric significance of a bee that Asser uses here. That's the second time that he's used the bee as an analogy. Treefids, any thoughts on this translating into English?
Yeah, I'm not necessarily a language expert, but I do know that, as languages evolve, Latin was probably a very advanced, language at this point, while Saxon was probably quite primitive. So it can be difficult to translate, entire scriptures. You have to really think how you can put it into Saxon. You know what I mean? When you translate from one language to another. But gradually Alfred was able to do it. And I would like to add that books were very hard to come by back then. I think where he says leaves, I'm not sure if he literally means he had to write it on leave just temporarily until he could find a proper pamphlet or parchment or scripture. But it's great that Alfred was carrying this book around all the time to remember certain scriptures and quotes from the Bible, you know, to always be on his mind, to keep him just and to be a good king, right? So he was always thinking, you know, about what to do in the laws of God. And in the Bible, it says that David was always meditating on God's laws all the time as well. And God said that David was a man after the heart of God, right? So he really was a just person. And Alfred seems to have modeled himself on David, right?
Yeah, David was a big hero to him. I think the leaves would have either been parchment or it would have been vellum, because you had vellum, which I think was goat skin or something like that, that they would write on as well. And that would last longer than parchment. But they had parchment as well. And I guess leaves must go back to the papyrus leaves from Egypt. I should imagine that's probably where this idea that a page is a leaf, where that actually comes from. I think they still use the word leaf today in bookbinding. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Just a question. When it says, you know, the languages were translated to Saxon, I mean, my question is, I thought the Saxons were somewhat illiterate. So is it Anglo-Saxon and the amalgamation of their culture?
It must be. It's basically what became English. Old English. They had this alphabet. I suppose they had the Latin alphabet. So what they must have done is like started to spell their own words, their own Anglo-Saxon words. And we're told that the English that we have today goes back to Anglo-Saxon and Norman, and it goes back to German. But we're unable to understand German in the same way that a Welsh person can actually understand Breton or Cornish, because they're related languages, but we're unable to understand German. Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett, they say that's because English actually goes back to the Iceni. It was the language that the Iceni spoke. And there's a record from the time that says that everybody spoke the language of the Iceni tribe, and that was the common language. So it may be that English originates really in the language of the Iceni. But then added to that, there would have been words that came over with the Saxons that they used. And then with the Normans, we had French words that were added to it. And then we had like Latin words that were used. And there's a good audiobook that I did on English. And there was this guy from a couple of hundred years back, and he studied the use of the English language. And he was basically trying to isolate words that were specifically Anglo-Saxon. And there's some very lovely ways of describing things. And I pointed this out before, that the word L-O-R-E, that goes back to the Saxon language. So astronomy would be star lore, L-O-R-E, rather than astronomy, which goes back to a Latin word. See, a lot of the words that we use, the Normans replaced the Saxon version with a Latin version, which just makes English very complicated to study. But yeah, Alan Wilson say that it goes back to the Iceni tribe. That's where the origins of English actually comes from. So if you want an alternative explanation.
Then they're a native Breton tribe on the east sort of coast, are they?
Yeah, well, the Iceni, I think that was the tribe that Boadicea came from. I think she came from the Iceni. So I think she was up sort of around about the Liverpool area, a Midlands sort of area. I'll have to try and find some
info. I think looking on a map, it's on the west coast, close to places like Mablethorpe, around up and around them areas.
Yeah, well, apparently that was the tribe, that was the lingua franca, the main language that was spoke by people. And then they also had Latin. So I think there would have been obviously an influence from the Anglo-Saxons. But if you think, or they're from original Germanic language, but if you think they'd been in Britain for 400 or 500 years by this time, and there would have been a common language that everybody was speaking, which was different to the Welsh language. Because it does make sense that if the Welsh can understand Breton and Cornish, because they all originate in the same language, we should be able to understand German, and the Germans should be able to understand English in the same way. But English and German are both very, very different, aren't they?
Yeah, and also if you consider, if the tribe was predominantly on the eastern coast lands, which was where a lot of the Danes invaded, they would have been a lot more influenced, you know, where they'd settled compared to the Welsh, right? So The language would have been influenced, had a different influence.
Yeah,
I think what one difference between English and all the other continental languages is that we always embraced all these other, you know, words and languages and just amalgamated them, whilst the other continental languages, they shunned it. That, you know, like the French hate it when you bring in an English word, whilst, you know, here we have the coup de grace and voila, and you know we just don't mind if you bring in a French word or a German word or a Welsh word. We just embrace it, and that's why our language, as well, it will sound perhaps arrogant, has become the greatest language, because it's all the best words, you know, put together. And that's largely what I think it would be difficult to trace back, because we've just combined all languages to make a superior language, right? English.
Yeah, I just point out there that when I got mixed up there between Boadicea and Curtis Mander, I think. Boadicea was down at Colchester. So that's where you were pointing out there, Patriarch. And I was getting her mixed up with Curtis Mandua, who was the queen that gave Caractacus to the Romans. And that was the one that was around about the Liverpool area. So I got mixed up between the two. So yeah, Boadicea was from Colchester, that area on the east. And yeah, that, I think you're right there, Truefids, about the English language. Well, let's see what Wikipedia says about these translations. Alfred's educational ambitions seem to have extended beyond the establishment of a court school, believing that without Christian wisdom, there can be neither prosperity nor success in war. Alfred aimed to set to learning, as long as they are not useful for some other employment, all the freeborn young men now in England who have the means to apply themselves to it. So those that were bright enough to cope with it. Conscious of the decay of Latin literacy in his realm, Alfred proposed that primary education be taught in English, with those wishing to advance to holy orders to continue their studies in Latin. There were few books of wisdom written in English, though. Alfred sought to remedy this through an ambitious court-centred programme of translating into English the books he deemed the most necessary for all men to know. It is unknown when Alfred launched this programme, but it may have been during the 880s when Wessex was enjoying a respite from Viking attacks. Alfred was, until recently, often considered to have been the author of many of the translations, but this is now considered doubtful in almost all cases. Scholars more often refer to translations as Alfredian, indicating that they probably had something to do with his patronage, but are unlikely to be his own work. Apart from the Lost Handbook, or Enchiridion, which seems to have been a commonplace book kept by the king, the earliest work to be translated was the Dialogues of Gregory the Great, a book greatly popular in the Middle Ages. The translation was undertaken by Alfred's command by Werferth, Bishop of Worcester, with the king merely furnishing a preface. Remarkably, Alfred, undoubtedly with the advice and aid of his court scholars, translated four works himself: Gregory the Great's Pastoral Care, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, St. Augustine's Soliloquies, and the first 50 Psalms of the Psalter. So, I mean, that's a lot of work in itself. That Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, I mean, that's so important that Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson devoted an Orthodox Nationalist to Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, because that was considered so central to our civilization, basically. And that's what Alfred was doing. He was translating the books that he thought were the most important for people to have access to. So that's right. And this gives us an idea of what was important to them. Pastoral Care, written by Gregory the Great, a great book on philosophy here, and the first 50 Psalms of the Psalter. So that could be understood in the vernacular. You didn't have to just learn Latin. I mean, it just gets more incredible the more you actually hear about Alfred and what he achieved. Any thoughts on these translations, Truefids?
Yeah, I mean, to translate the Bible, entire, that takes decades. I think the King James Version, when it was authorized, you know, King James set up a team. I think it was like a team of 50 or 100 people, and it took him about 4 or 5 years. So you know, one man, it would take a lifetime to do it. And obviously, you know, he's a king, he's running a kingdom. So he had to just pick what he considered the best. The Psalms are probably the easiest because they're very short. And that's probably why he translated those ones. He probably didn't do it, you know, literally himself. He probably had bishops and other learned men around him, and they would do it together, right? And then bit by bit, he got translations. So we don't really know who would technically gain the credit. But the important thing is that he really wanted the scriptures and other, you know, important works to be available to the common people. I believe he even made sure that each major church, they'd have like a copy by the church so anyone could walk up and read it. That was, I read that somewhere, but that was Alfred who started that, so that you could go to any church, any common person, if they could read, they could go and, you know, have it available. And of course, we continue that. There was a point where I believe every hotel in the world had to have a Bible in the drawer, right? So anybody could read that. Of course, that's all been done away with because it's considered, you know, evil, and we can't only have Christian, but that's how we used to be, right?
Yeah, that was a Gideon's Bible. I can remember that. Gideon's Bible used to be everywhere. I can remember learning about that at school. Whereas I guess today they would say, well, it's Islamophobic or it's anti-Semitic not to have other religious books there as well. Crazy stuff. But I didn't realize that was a tradition that actually originated here with Alfred. That goes all the way, well, it did go all the way through today with the Gideon Bibles. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, the old they used to have hotel in every hotel room. There's a Bible as well, wasn't there? You open your drawer and there's a Bible there. Not anymore though. But yeah, no. I mean, Alfred must have been a busy man. Must have dedicated his whole life to just every waking hour to bettering the kingdom. So obviously, Testament and like Truthvid said, it's highly doubtful that he, you know, translated everything himself. He had so much to so many other things to manage as a king, but I suspect that it was similar to how they went about monitoring the judges. So they would kind of almost randomly pick maybe and then just you know, check over things and just manage it that way, and just have small subgroups or something, and just to watch over who's being consistent, who's not, and then just keep an eye on the ones that maybe aren't translating the best, and then kind of filter it that way. I suspect that's how he went about it.
Yeah, he also set up monasteries, didn't he? Because you'd have these monks that would be copying things in Latin, so then he must have had like another group of people translating from Latin into Saxon or into English, and then what they translated into English needed to be taken to the court school. And I should imagine he probably set up other schools as well. I mean, you wouldn't just have one school, a court school. You'd have different classes and what have you. So a lot of work went into this. As it was mentioned there, he translated the first 50 Psalms of the Psalter. King Alfred was a layman of exceptional religious devotion, as Asser tells us. He was in the invariable habit of listening daily to divine services and mass, and of participating in certain psalms and prayers, and in the daytime and nighttime offices. Given that the offices consist largely of psalmody, Alfred cannot but have been thoroughly familiar with the Psalter. Many psalms represent King David's anguished outpourings to God for help against his foreign enemies and for sustenance in his pursuit of divine knowledge. Alfred will have been struck by similarities between King David's situation and his own, and it is not misleading to regard Alfred's translations of the Psalter as an act of personal devotion. Alfred translated only the first 50 Psalms and was possibly prevented by death from completing the task. His translations are closely literal, and the introductions to each psalm were compiled by Alfred from various sources and helped to give a personal immediacy to their recitation. We'll have a look at them in a minute, but I can recall having arguments with pagans when people had pointed out similarities between King David and his fight with Goliath, and they'll start saying, oh, King David was Jewish. And you say, well, no, King David wasn't Jewish, and actually he was the greatest hero of the greatest Saxon king. And he was emulating King David when he set all these things up. And they would argue that, oh, no, he wasn't. He was, you know, he was this pagan Saxon. You can say, well, why did he personally translate 50 of the Psalms that King David wrote if King David wasn't his greatest hero? And it really does, you know, shut down the pagans when you point that out. Any thoughts on Alfred's devotion to the Bible here, Treefitz?
Yeah, I would first point out that King David was described as being white and ruddy, right, by Samuel twice, and so was his son Solomon. So clearly they were white people, right? That's how we're described. But yeah, it just shows you that Alfred really took it seriously, and obviously it was difficult having it all in Latin, and he really strived to translate it into the common tongue. I would also point out, I believe at this time, Beowulf was also put into writing. So he was also bringing in, old Anglo-Saxon tales, which was important because it was the history of the Saxons. And it's interesting in that book, possibly with some Christian influence, they said all the evil races spawned from Cain. That was the belief they had, all the non-human people. That's how they believed. The monster in Beowulf must have come from Cain. That was the belief back then.
Yeah, interesting stuff. That shows you, you know, the culture as well. It was a cultural aspect, I would say. You got a religious aspect with translating the Psalms into English, and then you got a cultural aspect writing Beowulf down in English as well. So, and learning the tales or the old folk tales as well as learning the Bible. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
He is obviously a people's king as well, and he was, you know, he was religious, but he obviously understood that there is the community aspect and cultural aspect, which is important for peoples as well, pastimes and tales and things. So, yeah, he was truly a wise man, wasn't he?
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's have a look at these Psalms here. We'll have a look at a couple of them. Got his introduction to Psalm 2. This is what he says. The text of the following psalm is called Psalmist David. That is David's psalm in English. It is so called because David, in this psalm, lamented and complained to the Lord about his enemies, both native and foreign, and about all his troubles. And everyone who sings this psalm does likewise with respect to his own enemies. So too did Christ with respect to the Jews. So Alfred is pointing out there that the Jews were Christ's enemy. And if we have a look at Psalm 2, I'll read that out. Why do all nations rage, and why do they contemplate useless undertakings? And why do the kings of the earth rise up, and noblemen come together against God and against him whom he chose as Lord and anointed? They say, let us break their bonds and cast away their yoke from us. What avails their talk, said the prophet, though they speak in this manner? For God who is in heaven derides them, and the Lord confounds them. And he calls out to them in his anger and confuses their scheme. And I, nevertheless, am placed by God as king over his holy Mount Sion, for the purpose of teaching his will and his law. For the Lord said to me, you are my son, I begot you this very day. Ask me, and I shall deliver the enemy peoples for your inheritance, and I shall extend your authority over their boundaries, and I shall bring it about that you rule them with an iron rod, and I can destroy them as easily as the potter can a pot. Hear now, you kings, and learn, you judges, who judge over the earth. Serve the Lord and fear him. Rejoice in God yet with awe. Embrace learning, lest you incur God's anger, and lest you stray from the right path. For when his anger is kindled, then blessed are those who now trust in him. So you got loads there. That was obviously a very important psalm to him, telling people that they needed to embrace learning, saying that he was king because God put kings in place over the nations, and also going after the enemies, smashing the enemies, not turning your other cheek to them. And again, and also there, and he points out, he's saying that Christ's enemy was the Jews. So he was obviously not thinking that Christ was a Jew, because his enemies were the Jews. Any thoughts on the introduction in Psalm 2, Truefitz?
Yeah, firstly, people always get confused with the Christ thing. They don't understand that Judea was basically a cosmopolitan mixed. It'd become a mixed nation. Really, it was a province in Rome, but there were separate groups. So you had Israelites, but you also had other people, notably the Edomites, who had married in with the race of Cain. And that's why there's all this contention. That's why they're constantly hounding and harassing Christ. And, you know, they refuse to believe him. But then you also get this separate group who do and follow him and become his apostles. That's what people need to read on and understand, and that will explain everything. But as with this psalm, it's also a messianic prophecy, right? That the son is going to be Christ eventually, and he's going to inherit the whole world, right? But his people will be the ones who gain the world. And if you look throughout history, only one people spread out and gain the whole world. And that would be us, right? That the Europeans, and we did it in his name, in Christianity. Although now we're in the end times, where the tables have turned and we're being overrun, right, by those enemies, right? That's what's happening, and that's us.
So very prophetic as well. Patriarch, any thoughts on Alfred's introduction and Psalm 2?
Not so much on that, just to follow on a point from Truefitz about where we are in the end times, and the woman in Revelation is the woman is essentially the seed of Israel, and the flood of the serpent is essentially that race of Cain mentioned and kind of being flooded in, essentially.
Yeah, we're the camp of the saints, aren't we? And the flood that comes from the serpent's mouth is all peoples, nations, and tongues that chase after the woman. And the woman is the whore of Babylon. And at the same time, the woman is also Israel, the bride waiting for the bridegroom. And what she's done is she's whored herself out. That's the Christian identity understanding of it. Moving on to Psalm XLV, and I'm not sure what that is. Obviously, it's further than Psalm 10. Oh, 45th Psalm, Psalm 45. David sang this 45th Psalm, thanking God that he had released him from his many afflictions. And he also prophesied that the men who are the two tribes, namely Judah and Benjamin, should do likewise, that they should thank God that he protected them from the siege and from the invasion of the two kings, Phasi, son of Remaliah, and Resin, king of Syria. It was not done through the merits of King Ahaz, but through God's mercy and the merits of the elders. It happened that the two kings were driven out by the king of the Assyrians. And he prophesied the same with respect to all righteous men who are first oppressed and then spared. And he prophesied the same with respect to Christ and the Jews. And I find that particularly interesting because he talks about the tribes, or the two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and he separates them from this group right at the end that he refers to as the Jews. So I think that implies that he knew that the tribe of Judah was not necessarily the Jews. I think he's referring to two different groups there. And I'll just pause there, Truefitz, for your thoughts on that before I read out the Psalms here. What do you make of the introduction there? Do you think I'm right that it implies he knew there was a difference between Jews and Judah and Benjamin?
Yeah, I believe so. If you read, I forgot his name, the Frankish, there was a bishop in France who wrote a history book. It might have been Gregory. But he also said that there were Jews coming in, and he said, you claim that you are the people of the Bible. So he didn't necessarily fully believe it, but he just said, you claim to be descended from them. So he was a bit not sure about it, right? So back then, people didn't necessarily accept it. They just weren't sure. And you know, different countries, different kings had different points on that. But I just wanted to point it out that people get confused often with Syria and Assyrians. So Syria was above Israel. That was actually Aram. And the Assyrians, they were from Asher. And then that would be above. They were both Shemites. So were the Israelites from Arphaxad. But here, importantly, you see that David realized that it wasn't about just building up a massive army and just winning through victory. He had to pray to God and be a righteous person. And if he did, God could just turn kings against each other and he could turn his enemies against them. So that was the real important thing. And back to Alfred, that Alfred also must have realized this, that he couldn't just through brute physical force beat the Danes. He had to rely on God. And if God was with him, even if he was outnumbered 10 to 1, he would still win. Anyways, that's the lesson here from David, who's pouring out, you know, of his heart to God for help, and God helps him.
Yeah, I think Syria was referred to as Coal Assyria, wasn't it? And Assyria was the other country. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just the three different groups. Only thing I would say I read recently about Benjamin being a light to Judah, wasn't it? It was like a tribal. A tribe that was prophesied as a ravenous wolf, but eventually became a tribe that was to be spiritually enlightened, I guess, and to be a light to Judah, and partly because they obviously had a lot of their men killed by the other tribes and almost completely wiped out, but then they married back into Ephraim, I think. So I think that changed the nature of Benjamin, and eventually went on to become a light to Judah. And obviously, great apostle Paul was from the tribe of Benjamin. And there's some studies suggest that a lot of the apostles were from the tribe of Benjamin too, having migrated out from Judah from the fear of King Herod. So they went further north, actually, and kind of went to and settled more in kind of the Galilee region where Christ picked his apostles from.
Yeah, I think there's actually some bits in the Old Testament that say that Benjamin went to that Galilee region as well. So we know that the disciples came from that from the region that we're told they came from. That is where the tribe of Benjamin were. Yeah, I think it's written in the two books. I momentarily forget their names. The two books that are written when the tribe of Judah and Benjamin come back from captivity. I can't recall the name of them. Do you know the two books that I'm thinking of, Truthfids? I can't.
I think it might be Chronicles and Kings.
No, it's not Chronicles or Kings. It's
You mean Ezra and Nehemiah?
Yeah, that's it. Ezra and Nehemiah. It says in there about where they go back to, and the tribe of Benjamin go back to the specific place where the disciples were taken from, and obviously Judas Iscariot. That means the Jew Iscariot. Basically, so that the one out of the disciples that wasn't actually from Benjamin is the one that sold Christ out. Well, getting back to here, this is what the actual psalm says: "The Lord is our protection and our strength and our support in our tribulations, which have befallen us exceedingly. Therefore, we shall not fear, even though all the earth is oppressed and the mountains are cast into the middle of the sea. Our enemies fall upon us so terribly that it seemed to us that all the earth shook with the tumult, and nevertheless they were frightened by God more severely than we, and their kings lifted up like the mountains were oppressed by God's might. Then God's fortress in Jerusalem rejoiced with the arrival of the shower which cleansed it. The Almighty consecrated his temple within the city. Therefore the city shall never be altered as long as God remains unalterably in its midst. God helped it very early in the morning, and the foreign peoples were afflicted, and their might was vanquished. The Almighty sent his word, and our land and our people were changed for the better, and they and their land for the worse. The Lord, the God of armies, is with us, and our defender is Jacob's God. Come and see God's work and the wonders which he works here on earth. He drives back from us every attack, far away beyond our borders, and he shatters our enemies' bows and crushes their weapons and burns their shields. Then God responded to the prophet's spirit and said again through the prophet, Relax now and see that I alone am God, and raise me up above the foreign peoples. And even among these peoples am I exalted. The Lord God of armies is with us, and our defender is Jacob's God. So interesting there that he draws a distinction between them and the foreign peoples, and sees them as enemies, basically. Thoughts on this psalm, Truefords?
Notice that it says at the end, Jacob's God, not, you know, the believers or the non-believers or the spiritual Israel. It's just the God of Jacob, so only Jacob's descendants. You must wonder, did David realize that? Did Alfred realize that when he read that? You'd want to go ask him, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he might well have done. He might have understood that, because in the brute, it times everything that happens in the brute with what's happening in Jerusalem, you know, the brute and the early chronicle of England. So it's sort of referring to what was happening in the Old Testament, as it's also referring to what's happening in Britain. And we know from that Treaty of Arbroath, or the Declaration of Arbroath, that the Scots dated everything back to the Exodus. So yeah, it is conceivable that he understood that, he himself was descended from them. And also in the family tree, takes him back to Adam. And I think it takes him, I'm not sure if it takes him back through Shem. It takes him back to Noah and then through to Adam. So obviously he understood that's where he went back to basically his line. Patriarch, any thoughts on this psalm?
Yeah, I mean, he clearly understood it well, and with such a fascination of David, I think he clearly understood he was of the same lineage. You know, it's hard to imagine how someone could revere and have such high regard for a foreign king that wasn't of the same kind of, you know, wasn't kindred, or at least the father of, you know, a people that essentially rejected Christ, you know, and despised him. So I think he clearly understood, you know, the true origins of Christ, the Bible, the Jews, and so on.
Yeah, it's very clear that Alfred doesn't see himself as being amongst the foreign peoples in that are destroyed by God. I mean, he's seeing himself as a descendant of David, part of those peoples. Well, moving into the final part of our notes here, Alfred died on the 26th of October, 899, at the age of 50 or 51. How he died is unknown, but he suffered throughout his life with a painful and unpleasant illness, which we've discussed. It could have been Crohn's disease. I mean, it started off with piles and then it became something different. His biographer, Asser, gave a detailed description of Alfred's symptoms, and this has allowed modern doctors to provide a possible diagnosis. It is thought that he had either Crohn's disease or hemorrhoids, and his grandson, King Edred, seems to have had a similar illness. Alfred was temporarily buried at the Old Minster in Winchester with his wife, Ealhswith, and later his son, Edward the Elder. Before his death, he had ordered the construction of the new minster, hoping that it would become a mausoleum for him and his family. 4 years after his death, the bodies of Alfred and his family were exhumed and moved to their new resting place in the new minster, and they remained there for 211 years. When William the Conqueror rose to the English throne after the Norman conquest in 1066, many Anglo-Saxon abbeys were demolished and replaced with Norman cathedrals. One of those unfortunate abbeys was the very New Minster Abbey, where Alfred was laid to rest. Before demolition, the monks at the New Minster exhumed the bodies of Alfred and his family to safely transfer them to a new location. The New Minster monks moved to Hyde in 1110, a little north of the city, and they transferred to Hyde Abbey, along with Alfred's body and those of his wife and children, which were interred before the high altar. In 1536, many Roman Catholic churches were vandalised by the people of England, spurred by disillusionment with the church during the dissolution of the monasteries, and one such Catholic church was the site of Alfred's burial, Hyde Abbey. Once again, Alfred's place of rest was disturbed for now the third time. Hyde Abbey was dissolved in 1538 during the reign of Henry VIII. The church site was demolished and treated like a quarry, as the stones that made up the abbey were then reused in local architecture. The stone graves housing Alfred and his family stayed underground and the land returned to farming. And these graves remained intact until 1788, when the site was acquired by the county for the construction of a town jail. Before construction began, convicts that would later be imprisoned at the site were sent in to prepare the ground to ready it for building. And while digging the foundation trenches, the convicts discovered the coffins of Alfred and his family. The local Catholic priest, Dr. Milner, recounts this event, and he says, "Thus miscreants couch amidst the ashes of our Alfreds and Edwards, and where once religious silence and contemplation were only interrupted by the bell of regular observance, the chanting of devotion, now alone resound the clank of the captives' chains and the oaths of the profligate. In digging for the foundation of that mournful edifice, at almost every stroke of the mattock or spade, some ancient sepulchre was violated, the venerable contents of which were treated with marked indignity. On this occasion, a great number of stone coffins were dug up, with a variety of other curious articles, such as chalices, patens, rings, buckles, the leather of shoes and boots, velvet and gold lace belonging to the chasubles and other vestments, as also the crook, rims and joints of a beautiful crozier, double gilt. The convicts broke the stone coffins into pieces, and the lead which lined the coffins was sold for 2 guineas, and the bones within were scattered around the area." And that is such a sad ending to the story, to think that that's what actually happened. He had such a glorious reign, and then he died, and they tried to look after his body. I mean, you can see the Normans had respect. They moved the body, the Normans did, even though the Normans were not impressed with the Saxons, and they still showed him respect. But by the time you get to Henry VIII and his looting operation, where they smashed up all the monasteries and gave the lands to Henry VIII's lords, this is what happened to it. And it wasn't until they constructed a jail on the site in 1788 that they discovered that the bodies were still there, and they just destroyed everything and stuck a prison there. It's like, you know, just total desecration of England's greatest king. I think you can safely say that Alfred the Great was England's greatest king. And, you know, he just desecrated his grave. It's just incredible to me that happened. Truthfeds, what are your thoughts on this, and any final thoughts to finish up with?
Yeah, I think that's quite sad. Unfortunately, that's often the case, right? And now we see many of statues of, you know, ancient heroes being desecrated and brought down because of multiculturalism is just the thing that's happening now, right? But yeah, it's interesting that we didn't used to have cathedrals. It was William the Conqueror that brought all that, you know, the big over-the-top giant cathedrals. I think that's likely because he needed support to conquer England. So he promised the, you know, the Pope and the Catholic Church that he would build Catholic churches there, and he would make England a Catholic nation. I believe before that, England was somewhat self-autonomous from the popes, right? Even though, of course, that they would have spoke to each other and, you know, they weren't against each other. I think under William, he probably brought them under the heel more, and he needed that support from the Catholic Church because I believe he only invaded with 20,000 men, was it? Perhaps that. And that's why he needed, you know, the extra support. And that's why we had all these giant cathedrals, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because in 1060, there was a schism, wasn't there? And you ended up with the Eastern Orthodox Church and then the Roman Catholic Church. And at that time, up until 1060, England was Anglo-Orthodox, and they looked to Constantinople to solve these issues rather than to Rome. And then in 1060, you had this split of what was one church, the Catholic Church, that split, and you had the Roman Catholic Church and you had the Eastern Orthodox. And then 1066, just 6 years later, you have William the Conqueror comes over with the support of the Pope into England. So yeah, that was to, like, yeah, I think it could well have been a part of it, Truthfids, that it was in order to make sure that England stayed with the Roman Catholic side rather than stayed with the Orthodox side and following the Greek Eastern Orthodox Church rather than following the Latin Roman Catholic Church. Patriarch, any thoughts on the death of Alfred and what became of him? his body.
Yeah, it's quite tragic, isn't it? But, you know, all kind of heroes fall by the wayside eventually. But, I mean, the important thing is that his name lives on, and all of his accomplishments aren't forgotten. You know, that can often happen with some great kings and some great people. So, you know, at least we're here now talking about him and kind of, you know, learning and informing others about how great he was, and kind of just showing him, you know, how important his life was to our people and the shaping of Britain, essentially, as fundamentally, you know, a strong Christian nation, which helped us to thrive and do what we've done.
Yeah, his memory lives on, and it was a great inspiration. The Eastern Orthodox, they refer to him as Saint Alfred the Great, because he was sainted. So those remains, I mean, they would have been relics as well that were just absolutely desecrated. But yeah, it's a fantastic tale, a great inspiration to us all, I think. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truthfits.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Sven.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.